Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Cy Kellett, your host. Open forum today with two very, very fine guests. Second hour, Father John Trigilio will be here with us. First hour, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, senior apologist Jimmy Akin.
Hello, host of Catholic Answers Live, Cyril Kellett.
Nice to see you again. It feels so long since I've seen you.
Yeah, like,
morning.
3 hours.
Yeah. We're doing a little pre-recording because we got to do pre-recording. Because we're not here every day.
Because it won't record itself.
No, it ain't going to record itself, Jimmy. Somebody's got to push those buttons and say them words. So it was fun recording the...
Next Tuesday's open forum.
Yeah. Not next Tuesday. No,
oh,
a couple
weeks. Yeah. Christmas week, Tuesday's open forum.
Right, where we talk about Christmas. It's all Christmas questions and some really, really good ones in there, including what Jimmy eats on for Christmas dinner, which absolutely fascinating answer. But I'm not going to get into it. Our number
it
here
surprised you, though, didn't it?
Utterly surprised. As I said, as we were recording, if you had given me 20 chances to guess, I would have missed all 20. There's no way I could have gotten that in 20 guesses. Okay, so it's open forum. You can call and ask any question you'd like about the Catholic faith.
Maybe instead of 20 guesses, if you'd had 20 questions, you could have narrowed it down. Because you would have proceeded, rather than random country guessing...
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, guessing you could have gone systematically. It's like,
which continent?
Which hemisphere? Then which continent? Then
yeah, right. 20 questions is just yes or no, right?
Yes. So typically,
I wouldn't start with Australia, so I'd have a pretty good chance to be in them. I'd start with the big three. Well, I mean, I say the big three, but Africa, Asia, Europe, but only because they're all clumped together as one big. But they're not bigger than. I don't know what I'm talking about right now. 888-318-7884. I really don't think that anyone wants to hear me meditating on the size of the various continents. 888-318-7884. Call with any question you've got, whether you're a Catholic or not, or Christian or not. If you have an interest in the Bible, in Jesus, in morality, in philosophy, in science, or in anything else, you're welcome to call and ask Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884. I will go to the phones, but while we are processing calls, let me just ask you what's on your mysterious world, Jimmy Akin's mysterious world.
So last week we started looking at the countdown to Pearl Harbor. The Pearl Harbor event in December of 1941. So this is the 80th anniversary of it. And there's a question of, was there a conspiracy to either make Pearl Harbor happen on purpose on the part of some in the American government, or let it happen on purpose, much like there were questions about 9/11 in that regard. And we started looking at that question, but then we led up to the introduction of a particular individual named Harry Dexter White. And Harry Dexter White was an official in the Treasury Department. He was the brains behind Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, and he was very influential. And he was a Soviet spy.
Now, that's speculation, right?
No. We know this because of a project called Venona, in which we decrypted a bunch of Soviet spy message traffic. And the Venona decrypts talk repeatedly about Harry Dexter White and things they were learning through him and stuff. And he played a role in the negotiations leading up to Pearl Harbor.
How interesting.
And the Soviets very much wanted the U.S. to get into a war with Japan because they were being pounded on their Western front by Hitler's Operation Barbarossa and were in danger of collapsing. In fact, the Allies expected the Soviet Union to fall within a year to Hitler. And so they were desperate to not have the Japanese attack them on their Eastern front. And so they contacted Harry Dexter White, and we're going to be telling you all about that.
Oh, that's the rest of the story.
Yeah.
888-318-7884. Open forum. Your questions, very, very welcome. You can find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the internet by just typing in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and lots of people have, and they're happy that they did. Let's start with Theodore right here in Dana Point, California, just up the road from us a bit, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Theodore, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Cy. Hi, Jimmy. I have a question, but first, have I heard right that Tim Staples had a stroke?
You did hear right. But the one thing that I've been trying to say before I say that every time on the air is he seems to be doing quite well. And so he's recovering. Oh. But as you would imagine, a man with seven children and whatnot, very cautious and slow going as far as what he's going to take up next, but seems to be doing, from all reports we're getting, very, very well. As a matter of fact, we start each week with Darren makes a phone call to say, is this the week you want to come back, or are we going to give it another week? And so that's where we are right now.
Well, my prayers and thoughts are with
Thank
him.
You.
He's just such a great asset. He the is. Catholic world.
Oh my goodness! Yes,
Jimmy. My question.
Before we go to your question, I also wanted to mention one other thing, which is apparently the stroke that Tim had did not impair cognitive function at all.
Right. Oh, that's right. Yeah, he's having a little trouble with balance, as far as I understand. But he's the same old Tim. He's probably still answering questions right now as we speak. But all right, go ahead with your question, Theodore.
All right, that's good to hear. My question is, and he probably answered this a million times, but as a amateur apologist, I've been trying to read up on and understanding God being fully man and human. And my question is, if God has no space or time, mm-hmm. and thereby being infinite, and man is subject to space and time and is therefore finite, then how can Jesus be fully God and man being both finite and infinite, as Jesus would be a finite part of God, and therefore God would by definition being infinite, have no finite parts limited by space or time?
Okay, so it seems to me that part of the issue here may be thinking of God as spatially infinite, as if God fills all of space. And that's actually not a fully literal way, or that can't be understood in a fully literal sense, because God does not fill space the way we do. Our bodies have certain dimensions. A typical human is between 5 and 6 feet tall and weighs somewhere between 100 and 300 pounds and has a certain volume. And that's because humans are physical creatures. They have spatial bodies that fill space, or to use the philosophical term that the medievals developed, they have extension in space and time. They are extended over space, through space and over time. And God is not like that. And God, even though we speak about God as if he's omnipresent, meaning he can, among other things, act anywhere in the universe, he doesn't have a body that actually fills space. God is non-extended in space and time. And so that's not the nature of God's infinitude. God's infinitude, the fact he's infinite, is to be understood in a different way. Not as if he literally fills space, but as he has infinite perfection. And Jesus has a human nature in addition to his divine nature. It is his divine nature that is infinite, meaning it's infinite in perfection. So he has all knowledge, all power, all holiness. It's infinite in all these perfections. But in addition to this divine nature, he has a finite human nature, and the finite human nature does fill space because he has a human body, and his human body has certain dimensions, and the two are, I'm trying to avoid using big words like incommensurate, but the two really don't have anything to do with each other in the sense that his finite nature is finite and fills space finitely, but his divine nature does not fill space. And so that we shouldn't think of Jesus's human nature as like a little pocket within a vast infinite sea of space-filling God.
Right. Okay.
And if that were the issue, well, then we would all be part of God. mm-hmm. because we're all, or at least all within God, and we would have to maybe like displace God, which wouldn't make any sense, the way fish displace the water in the
right,
sea.
Right.
And so I think the root of the issue may be in thinking about God as if he literally fills space when in fact he doesn't.
I think I got to go to a break, but is you satisfied with that, Jimmy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I don't know if Theodore is, but
well,
I
all right, I'll ask him. I'll see if Theodore's. Theodore, go ahead. I didn't know if you wanted to go back and forth is what I meant, but mm-hmm. Theodore, what's your question? I mean, yeah, are you happy with that?
Well, I'm glad you asked because I did say that God has no space or time, mm-hmm. but I just don't understand. If Jesus is fully human, then if he is fully human by definition, then he would have to be limited to space and time.
Well, his human nature is. Now, I think that we may have a second issue here, which is understanding what is meant when we say God, Jesus is fully human and fully divine. We don't mean fully in the sense of that's only what he is. We mean that in the sense of he has a complete or full human nature. And in the same way, he has a complete or full divine nature. But sometimes the word fully could be used in another sense that could be potentially confusing. For example, if I have a Reese's peanut butter cup,
mm-hmm.
if someone said, well, this is fully chocolate, well, they would then say, well, how does it have any peanut butter? Or if they right. said if it's fully peanut butter, what would they? Well, then can it also be chocolate?
Right.
Well, in the case of a Reese's peanut butter cup, it is neither completely chocolate or completely peanut butter.
Right.
It is a combination of both. But the peanut butter it has in it is fully peanut butter.
Oh yes, right, right.
And the chocolate it has in it is fully chocolate. Yep. And in the same way, Christ has two natures, divine and human, and each of those natures is complete in and of itself. So he has a full or complete human nature, which is finite, and a full or complete divine nature, which is infinite.
And now I got to leave that for the break. Theodore, thanks. I hope it was helpful. You call again. We can follow that up if you'd like. Two great tastes that taste great together. Jimmy Akin and Open Forum. More of that right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
A lot of people that I think are holy, and then 5 years later, you find out, oh.
Yeah. Yes.
And then there are other people that, let's just say, maybe lack some social suavité, some sophistication, and you think, well, that was rude. And then you get to know them, and 5 years later, you realize, you know, beneath that rough exterior, there's a heart of gold.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders, tonight, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Back, Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Ask whatever you like, 888-318-7884. Particularly warm welcome, Matt, out for if you are not a Catholic or Christian and you have a question about what we believe, what we think, what our practices are, you're very welcome. 888-318-7884. Going now to Louie in Kalamazoo, Michigan, listening on Holy Family Radio. Glad to have you, Louie. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello.
Hi, Louie.
So, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I got a question for you in regards to this weekend scriptures, Hebrews 10, 5 through 10, where they refer to prepare a body for him.
Mm-hmm.
And in the catechism, they have this referenced under Mary's predestination under the catechism 488. And it says, God sent forth his son but to prepare a body for him. He wanted the free cooperation of a creature. For this, and for Almighty God, chose for the mother of his son a daughter of Israel. So my question is, are they referring and saying a body prepared for me? Are they referring to the preparation of Mary's body?
No.
The preparation of Jesus?
They're referring to God preparing a human form for his son. And in the catechism, which is what the book of Hebrews is referring to, and in the catechism, it is highlighting the fact that God wanted not just to prepare a body for his son, which he could have done on his own. I mean, he created the universe by saying, let there be light and things like that. He could easily have just said, let there be a body for my son, and it would have materialized out of nothing. But he didn't want to do it that way. He wanted to do it in a way that involved the free cooperation of a creature who is the Virgin Mary. So he wanted Mary to freely agree to become the mother of his son. He didn't want like a cosmic impregnation against her will. So right. Gabriel was sent to her and given this prophecy, which she freely accepted, and that was part of the process by which God prepared his son's human body.
Louis, I'm going to leave it there because many lines full, but thank you very much for the question. Very clear question, and glad to have you. Let's go to Giro in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, listening on 105.9 FM. Giro, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, guys. I was just wondering, I've been reading through some of the Pentateuch, and I was noticing that many of the punishments for breaking rules is stoning or death. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering why that is in so many of these laws.
It's because, there are a number of factors, but one of the key ones is the world was economically underdeveloped at the time. And as a result, they didn't really have hardly any prisons. They might have prisons that they would put people in temporarily, like if they were awaiting trial, but prison itself was not viewed as a debtor's prison where you're in until you can get your relatives to cough up the money to bail you out. But they didn't really view prison as a punishment or a societal protection measure the way we do, because prison, they didn't want to have a lot of people in prison. It didn't make sense to them to say, oh, well, here we have this person who's been doing stuff that's wrong, so let's put him in a building and feed him and clothe him and pay people to take care of him for extended periods of time, like years or the rest of his life or things like that, because that's expensive. You got to build the building. You got to pay for all his food. You got to pay for his clothing. You got to pay for guards to keep him there. It's a big, expensive proposition to keep someone in prison. And so it didn't make sense to people in the ancient world to use incarceration as a principal way of dealing with crime. To them, once you determined that someone had broken the law and was guilty of an offense, you wanted to deal with them immediately. So you either had mercy on them and let them go, mm-hmm. or you exacted a fine that they could pay and you let them go, or you beat them and you gave corporal punishment and let them go, or you disfigured them and let them go. Like in Egypt, for example, for various offenses, you might cut off someone's nose. And that way, in the future, everyone who sees you would know, watch out for you because you've done criminal activity. You're a criminal if you had your nose cut off. And or in some cases, in some cultures, like if someone robbed with their hand, they'd cut their hand off. So you couldn't rob that way anymore. And that was viewed as a way of dealing with the problem. Or if the problem was severe enough, you could banish them, get rid of them that way. But that was another instantaneous way of dealing with people. And then finally, if they did something that was bad enough, you would kill them. And all of these were basically instantaneous ways of dealing with the crime, so that once a person's guilt had been established, you effectively dealt with it and got it over, and you didn't have an ongoing obligation to take food and resources away from other people, from the public, who were overwhelmingly desperately poor, and use them to subsidize a comfortable or even an uncomfortable lifestyle for your criminals.
Okay, Jiro.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. The number, 888-318-7884. Two lines open right now. 888-318-7884. We'll go to Derek in Pennsylvania watching on YouTube next. Derek, go ahead with your question.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, thank you.
I was just wondering, can you please explain to me the word brother in the New Testament and how it's used for, I guess, relative, but Paul refers to somebody and that he's in prison with as cousin, and then when Mary goes to Elizabeth, she refers to Elizabeth as her cousin.
No, yeah.
And they use the word sister and everything like that. So okay. Can you just explain this whole brother thing?
Yeah. So the term brother in Hebrew and in Aramaic basically means male relative. Any male relative can be described as a brother, and any female relative can be described as a sister. With a couple of exceptions, if you are descended from someone, that person is not your brother but your father. And so that would apply to your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather. All of those are your father. Similarly, if someone is descended from you, no matter how many generations distant they are, they're your son. So your son is your son, your grandson is your son, your great-grandson is your son, and so forth. But unless you're descended from someone, or unless someone is descended from you, they are a brother. And some of that Hebrew idiom and Aramaic idiom spills over into the Greek. And so you will find passages in the Greek Old Testament where, even though a relationship like Abraham and Lot is really a uncle-nephew relationship, it gets described as we're brothers. And so that's just part of how the language gets used in this situation, because it's not purely normal Greek, it's translation Greek, where you have Hebrew and Aramaic speakers translating their thoughts into Greek. So some of that idiom spills over. But in the case of this in the case of Luke 1:36, where in some versions of the Bible it will describe Elizabeth as Mary's cousin, it has nothing to do with that. And frankly, I'm a little bit annoyed at people who repeat this constantly, that it says Elizabeth is Mary's cousin, because, and in particular, and most of them are doing it through no fault of their own. And it just complicates and confuses it for other people. But the people I'm really annoyed at are the translators of the 1970s edition of the New American Bible, because they use the word cousin in that passage, and it is not what it says in the Greek, and it causes endless confusion for ordinary people for them to have translated it that way, because in contemporary English, the word cousin is understood by an ordinary listener at Mass to mean first cousin.
Right.
That is not what the word is in Greek. There is a word for that in Greek. It's anepsios, and it is used by St. Paul in one of his letters. So the word for cousin is used, but that's not what the word means that's used in Luke 1:36. The word there is sungenes. And sungenes does not mean cousin. It means relative. And since this is a feminine form, sungenes, it's got a feminine ending on it, that means kinswoman or female relative. That's all it means. It does not connote anything more specific than Elizabeth is some kind of female relative of Mary, And as a result, we shouldn't get tangled up in any of this. Well, is she a cousin or what is it? Just says she's a female relative. And frankly, in the we're fortunate that in the revised edition of the New American Bible that came out a few years ago, they fixed this.
Yeah.
And other translations as well have fixed this. The idea that this should be translated cousin was originally in English was originally introduced in the 1400s by John Wycliffe. And back then, cousin didn't just mean first cousin. It meant something much broader where you have second and third and fourth cousins. And it did effectively just mean kinsman or kinswoman.
Yeah.
But cousin has narrowed in meaning in contemporary English, and it should not be translated that way in this passage. And it is not translated that way in the latest edition of the New American Bible. Thank God.
Derek, thank you. Thanks very much for that call and for that question. It's open forum. Three lines open, 888-318-7884.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Ladies, when you spend time with other women,
what do you like to do?
We'll discuss that tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
On most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin here with us. Father John Trigilio, next hour. Your questions welcome. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Chicago, Illinois. George in Chicago, Illinois, listening on Catholic.com, maybe even watching on Catholic.com. Glad to have you, George. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Glad to be, George.
So my question is, Roman Catholics and Orthodox alike, they use kind of the pre-schism unified church and continuity with it as a way of discerning if they're in the right place. Mm-hmm. So why would separation of the Bishop of Rome with the communion of the rest of the world's patriarchates not be an example of the mind of the unified church judging the See of Rome?
Well, because it isn't, number one, the patriarchate structure, I guess I'll just go for the key reason. But in essence, the patriarchate structure is not of the institution of Christ. And so Christ did not set up a patriarch of Alexandria and a patriarch of Antioch and a patriarch of Constantinople. The patriarchate structure is of human creation. And so it is not I'm going to try to avoid big words, but it is not fundamental. I wanted to say constitutive, but it is not fundamental to the structure of the church. And since it's an artificial creation, and it is an artificial creation that does not represent the entirety of Christendom, it is not capable of itself expressing a universal opinion on behalf of the church. And so the mere fact that you have one of the patriarchates in disagreement with others means you don't have unity on this question, whatever it may be. If one of the patriarchates disagrees with the other four, with the other patriarchates, then you don't have unanimity. And since this structure is not of divine institution, it doesn't speak for the whole church. And if you look at the actual situation, you had a very, very large number of Christians and bishops in communion with the Pope. So even when you had a separation between the East and the West, you don't have a situation where it's like the Pope all alone. It's like, the Pope and all the bishops that are still in communion with him and all of the faithful that are still in communion with him, this is not a matter of nose counting and saying, oh, well, let's take a political vote and see how many votes we got on one side versus another. The fact is that the Petrine Charism, the office of the Pope as the successor of St. Peter, is of divine institution. Originally, you know, Peter wasn't located in Rome. The fact it's in Rome is not of divine institution. You know, Peter was originally based in the Holy Land, but he then went to Rome and passed on his office there. And so the office of St. Peter is of divine institution, as we see in multiple Gospels, but especially in Matthew 16. And that's what's ultimately determinative of who you need to be in communion with, because that office was established by Jesus Christ and is fundamental to the constitution of the church, and is not something that Jesus said, oh, if you don't want to be in communion with Peter or his successor, that's okay. You know, as long as you got a number of other people who agree with you.
Right.
You know, it's the office of, to bend a slightly paraphrase the Code of Canon Law, the office of Peter is judged by no one. And so it would not matter if you had even a supermajority of people in agreement, as opposed to the office of St. Peter. The office of St. Peter is a divine institution and is not subject to human review.
George, thanks. Got to keep moving, but thank you very much for the question. I hope it was helpful to you. I'm going to go down to Alabama now. Kathy in Alabama, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Kathy, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, thank you. Hope you guys are doing all right tonight.
We are. Thank you.
It's raining.
So my question has to do with the resurrection and the ascension.
Mm-hmm.
So when Mary Magdalene meets Jesus and he tells her not to touch him because he hasn't gone to the Father yet, but then he comes and tells Thomas to put his hand through his side and, you know, check out his wound, he had not ascended then yet. Am I correct in this, or am
I? You're correct.
Way off base.
No, you got it. So do you spot an inconsistency there, or an apparent one?
Well, I'm just wondering why he told Mary not to touch him, but Thomas was able to touch him, and he had not yet gone to the Father.
All right. This is another instance where I think a translation problem has caused needless confusion.
Okay.
Even though you might be able to translate what Jesus says to Mary Magdalene as "Don't touch me," it also can be translated, and this is a much better translation: "Don't cling to me."
Okay.
Because I see, if you think about the situation psychologically, Mary believes that her Lord, who she loves, is dead. That's why she's there in the garden crying. And Jesus speaks to her, and at first she doesn't recognize it's him. She thinks it's the gardener. She says, hey, where have they taken my Lord's body? And then when she realizes it's him, she flips out.
Yeah.
She is so overjoyed. She thinks she's got him back. She thought she had lost him forever, and now here he is back. This is wonderful. I haven't lost you at all, Lord. I get to spend endless years with you because you're not dead after all. And he, in that context, warns her, look, don't cling to me because I'm going to ascend to my Father. So you may think you've got me back, but it's only for a limited amount of time. This is a limited time offer here.
Yeah.
And don't get too attached to me having come back.
Yeah.
So I think that's what he's doing with Mary Magdalene, and then obviously what he's doing with Thomas is assuring Thomas, no, I really am back here. Look, I mean, you said you wanted to examine these wounds. Go ahead and examine them.
All right, Kathy, it all makes sense to you?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much. Yep. I was thinking it was a little, you know.
Weird.
Yeah, like, man, don't be like, dissing Mary Magdalene.
No, he was not dissing Mary Magdalene. I'm glad we were able to reassure you on that point. Thanks, Kathy. Hope we'll talk again sometime. I'm going to go to Richard in Las Vegas now, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Richard, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. Great work.
Well, thank you.
My backstory is I'm a confessional Lutheran, and my question is, Mr. Aiken, what would you say are the three most important points of disagreement between confessional Lutherans and Catholics? And also, what would you say were the three most important points of agreement? Thank you.
Well, so I hope you can hang out, Richard, because I'll likely need some additional clarification. Now, first of all, you say you're confessional Lutheran. Would that mean that you're LCMS or LCWS, or what would you happen to be?
LCMS.
LCMS, okay. Oh, and for other people who may not be aware, LCMS means Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And it's going to depend because, you know, just like Catholics are not all of one opinion on everything, even confessional Lutherans are not all of one opinion on everything. But I would say one of the principal points of disagreement that that Catholics would have with some of the confessional documents that are used in the LCMS is the idea that the Pope is the Antichrist. We would say the Pope is not the Antichrist, and I think there's very good biblical reasons for that. I don't think the Pope fits the biblical model of the Antichrist at all. If you read what John is the only author of the New Testament to use the term Antichrist, and if you look at what he says about the Antichrist in his letters, it does not fit the office of the Pope. So that would, to my mind, be one of the principal disagreements. Also, with regard to confessional Lutherans, I think another principal point of disagreement would be the extent to which our understanding of justification is harmonious. As you may be aware, back in 1999, the Lutheran World Federation, which your group is not part of, and the Catholic Church signed a joint declaration on the doctrine of justification that concluded that actually we have a very substantial agreement on the doctrine of justification. And while there are some remaining differences, including differences of language and differences of emphasis, that we don't need to be divided on this question. And this position was broadly rejected in the confessional Lutheran movement, in the Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Synod. And so I would say that would be a notable point of disagreement. In terms of a third one, I don't know. I have individual things that I could think about that I don't know. I mean, they're what leap to my mind, but I don't know that I would elevate them to the same level because I don't think they principally deal with substance, but more with expression. Like, for example, in Lutheran theology, it's very common to divide passages of Scripture through a particular lens that wants to classify them of, is this law or is this gospel? And while the concepts of law and gospel are both important in Scripture, the way Lutheran theology uses those terms does not correspond with the way they're used in the Bible. And so there's a danger of misreading things in the Bible based on looking at them through this particular lens and trying to classify them in this way. But that is a matter of style. That is not a matter of substance. Just because someone's theological language doesn't fully correspond to the biblical language doesn't mean that you can't be right in what you're saying. It just means that you have to adjust for the fact that the language has evolved over time. And so I wouldn't, even though I don't find the law gospel language in Lutheran theology helpful or exegetically natural, I wouldn't say it's a substantive mistake. It may on occasion lead to substantive mistakes, but in and of itself, it's just a mode of using language. And as long as you recognize, well, here's how we're using these terms, but then here's how these terms are used in Scripture, it won't of itself cause a problem. You then mentioned what are things that for three, so those would be three potential points of disagreement. You then said three points of agreement. Well, Lutherans and Catholics are Trinitarians.
Yeah.
And they believe in the incarnation of Christ, and they believe that we're saved by God's grace through faith in the sacrament of baptism. And they believe in the real presence. And there's lots of stuff that we have in common and that we agree on. Those are some of the things that occur to me, at least off the top of my head. Are those helpful?
Oh, yeah. No, great job. Yes, very helpful. Thank you.
All right, awesome. Richard, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Next hour, Father John Trigilio will be here. Right now, it is digital mega sale time over at shop.catholic.com. Lots of stuff on sale, all the digital stuff, as a matter of fact. We've marked all of our ebooks, e-mags, digital videos, and MP3s down to $1, $3, or $5. Nothing is over $5. You'll also find our School of Apologetics courses at their lowest prices of the season. What are you waiting for? All of these deals run out at midnight tonight. Get on over to shop.catholic.com right now and find something digital for that someone special on your list.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hello, Father Mitch.
Yes, sir. What can we do for you?
How do we know that Jesus was in his early 30s during his ministry?
In Luke, he says, and Jesus was about 30 years old. So it's right there.
Okay, thank you. That was easier than I thought.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, The Fathers Know Best, The Drama of Salvation, many other things. Also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you should check out. And next hour, Father John Trigilial. Father John Trigilio will... No.
Trigilio.
Father Trigilio will be here with us. You know, hang on the line or call 888-318-7884. Mike in Green Bay, Wisconsin, watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Mike. Thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, welcome from the home of Aaron Rodgers and David Ricken, our bishop here.
Oh.
Question is about... halal butchers and meat preparation. I am trying very much to live my faith, not just believe it, and in doing so have been to a few halal butchers and have, you know, had excellent, what would you go to a butcher for? Quality, right? It's been great quality, but I now have stopped to think, is there something against our faith, or is that a proper thing for a Catholic to do?
Why would there be anything wrong with going to a halal butcher?
My understanding is that is prepared under a very specific set of Muslim laws, and certainly wouldn't want to have that get in the way of anything that, you know, I don't know how they do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know if there would be anything negative or against our faith that they.
Let me cut through this. The answer is no. There's nothing wrong with patronizing a halal butcher if they have good quality meats at a reasonable price. You don't need to worry about it, and I can show that using a very easy demonstration from the Bible. Now, Muslims, even though they don't fully understand God as well as Christians do, they have errors in their understanding of God. They at least worship the Creator. They worship the same God we do. But just like Jewish people who also, non-Christian Jewish people, who also don't have a complete understanding of God, you know, they don't believe in the Trinity, they don't believe Jesus is God's Son and things like that, they also nevertheless worship God, you know? Duh. Jesus says, you believe in God, believe also in me. So he clearly recognized that Jewish people worship the same God, even though they don't have an explicit belief in the Trinity. Well, the same thing's true of Muslims. So Muslims obviously aren't mentioned in Scripture because Muhammad didn't live until 600 years after the time of Christ. But, you know, there are other people who worshiped other gods in Scripture and
sacrificed to them.
And in 1 Corinthians, St. Paul addresses this very subject. He says, don't go into an idol's temple and worship there and partake of the food that sacrificed to an idol in its temple, because you can't do that and be a Christian. So that would be wrong. Don't go worship idols or participate in the food that is offered to them in their temple where the worship is going on. And then in the very same chapter, he turns around and says, but if it's sold in the meat market, don't worry about it. You can go over, because the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and everything God made is good, and we can receive it all with thanksgiving. And so as long as you know that and you're strong in conscience and you're not in the temple worshiping an idol, you can eat the meat that was offered to an idol. And he has a qualifier about if someone, you know, tells you, oh, well, this is offered to an idol. Well, you don't want to appear to condone idol worship. In that case, you might not want to eat lest you lead someone else into idol worship.
Right.
But there's nothing wrong with the food. You can eat it. It's totally fine. And so don't worry about it. Just give thanks to God. And this is typical of not just this situation, but, you know, any situation where in the ancient world, if you needed to buy food or anything else, you were going to be buying it from a pagan or maybe a Jewish person, because there weren't Christians around. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing wrong with patronizing non-Christians and purchasing goods and services from non-Christians, and that includes food. So it's not like Muslims have some kind of magical juju that they do to the food that's going to infect you or make it immoral to eat. That would be superstitious to think that they had magical powers like that.
Yeah.
So there's not a problem. If you can eat food that was sacrificed to Zeus and Apollo.
Yeah. And they don't make a sacrifice to
they're not. In fact, halal food preparation doesn't involve sacrifice. It may involve saying a prayer of thanks to the Creator.
Yeah.
But guess what? That's a good thing to do. And Jews did that too. So, no, there's no cause for concern here. I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay, Mike?
All right. And that was exactly my point. I didn't know what steps in preparation were and didn't want to cross any lines. That's all.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate that you said I want to live my faith, not just have it. I think that's
very commendable.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate that. Let's see. Where am I going now?
I'm going to
Caitlin in Pennsylvania, watching on YouTube. Caitlin, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
My question is, I want to get started in apologetics, specifically for the pro-life movement, but I kind of don't know where to start as it's overwhelming with information.
Okay. So you want to do pro-life apologetics specifically, is that correct?
Yes.
Well, I've written a lot about this, although I don't think any of it's in print at the moment. Trent Horn has a book.
Persuasive Pro-Life.
I would suggest getting a copy of that and reading that.
Okay, you said, what was the guy's name again? I'm sorry.
His name is Trent, T-R-E-N-T, Horn, H-O-R-N. And the book is called Persuasive Pro-Life, and you can get it at shop.catholic.com. Or anywhere you get books.
Well, I think we could even send it to her, can we?
Oh, that would be even better.
Let's just, Caitlin, if you don't mind giving us your home address, we'll have Sarah will take your address and we'll just send you a copy of Persuasive Pro-Life. And then as you have questions, call back. We got lots of apologists to help you along the road to defending life. And God bless you in that effort. I think we have time for one more. Caitlin, hang on that line. Let me go to Gerardo in San Antonio, Texas, listening on 89.7 Guadalupe Radio. Gerardo, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question.
Howdy, guys.
Howdy.
Thank you for taking my call. Couple of questions regarding, the first one is regarding the translation. Again, another translation question. We always regard to Greek as the language was the Gospels were written. So that does it mean that if the Greeks in have it all sorted out, if you learn Greek and go to Greece, do they have it all sorted out? That's my first question.
Well, okay. So the answer is no. Even if you, well, number one, Greek has changed in the last 2,000 years, just like every language changes. You know, English today is not the same as English was in the year 800 when English kind of started. And certainly Greek is not the same today as it was back then. So if you're a modern Greek speaker, you can read a good bit in the New Testament, but it is not contemporary Greek, and that's going to cause some issues right there. And then beyond that, there is the fact that even if you do know a language, like Cy and I know English, well, we have, in fact, we're both professional communicators in English, but that doesn't mean that we can instantaneously always understand exactly the meaning and all of the meanings of a text that is written down, because all languages contain ambiguity. And so as a result, even if you have a perfect knowledge of Greek or an advanced knowledge of Greek, even of New Testament Greek, that doesn't mean that it's going to instantly solve all of the potential interpretive difficulties you have in reading the New Testament. simply because language is ambiguous. And so you have to think carefully about, well, what does this text mean? What is the author trying to say? What are the different options? And you have to do that in Greek, just like you have to do that when you're reading in English, if you're an English speaker, or reading in Spanish when you're a Spanish speaker, or reading in German when you're a German speaker.
Gerardo, you can probably hear the music, so that means we got to leave it there. Thank you for the question. Thanks to everyone who called. If you're on the line, please stay on the line. We're just going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Father John Trigilio to answer your questions. And if you haven't dialed, there'll probably be a couple lines open now as we go into the break. You are welcome to call with your questions. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much.
Thank you. And we got Bible questions tomorrow, so get your Bible questions ready.
Oh, yeah. And anybody can call. You got a question about the Bible, you can call. And Jimmy's the author of the book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Many other things on the Bible. We'll be right back, and we'll see Jimmy tomorrow. We'll be right back with Father John Trigilio, Catholic Answers Live.